Okay, as far as sensational assertion, now with regard to the war that Sumner's writing about, the Spanish-American War, the sensational assertion was that the Spaniards had something to do with the sinking of the battleship Maine. And they would have been the last people in the world who had an incentive to instigate a war with the United States. The Spaniards were scared to death of having a war with the United States. And so they would never have done such a thing. It could have been the Cuban rebels. It could have been the U.S. government itself. But there's no evidence that the Spanish were involved in it. And if you look at the motive, they would have had no motive whatsoever to do such a thing. You know, fast forward to World War I, there was the sinking of the Lusitania, which we now know there was an expedition not too long ago, a diving expedition, that found out that the Lusitania had several million rifle rounds of ammunition in it. So it was carrying ammunition for the British. And it was sunk, and that was supposedly one of the reasons for American entry into World War I, the sinking of that ship. And so so we have all these sensational assertions, and of course, around World War I, everything German or related to Germans was sensationalized and demonized. The German was the Hun, he was the monster. And so the public has to be whipped up into a frenzy about the next monster to slay. And so that's point number one that Sumner makes. Another point he makes is that these imperialistic wars that the United States government has been involved in forever, seemingly forever, are always done in the name of self-government. You know, our objective supposedly is to impose self-government on some other people. Although he makes the point at the same time that all of this, as Randolph Warren said, is done in secret by the conniving and conspiring by a few people in the executive branch of government. There's no public opinion that is consulted. There are no opinion polls taken. There are no popular votes taken. And so there's no self-government involved in our prosecution of these wars. And so that's quite a big contradiction there. In the name of self-government, we abandon self-government and go to war. At the time, you know, the Spanish-American War and our attempt to take over the Philippines, the argument that was made that Sumner ridicules is that the argument was said that, well, here's what we're going to do. We're going to go and teach the Filipinos all about self-government. And then once we've given them their lesson in democracy, their civics lesson, we, the Americans, will leave. We'll do good for the world, teach them all about self-government, then we'll go home. And of course, we're still there. We still have naval base in the Philippines. And so that's another big lie that William Graham Sumner pinpointed. And that is the same story that is told today. Why is the U.S. government claiming to have a legitimate reason to intervene in Libya, Egypt, Syria? It's all democracy and self-government, supposedly. Same reason. Like I said, a lot of these things, a lot of these reasons for imperialism were handed down for many generations, even before William Graham Sumner's time. And he looks at history, you know, when Spain and France went down the road to imperialism, and the argument at Sumner's time was that, well, we should do this in the name of spreading democracy around the world. But Sumner pointed out correctly that Spain and France turned into monarchy. You know, the road to imperialism led to monarchy and despotism and bankruptcy. That's the history of all empires. They all bankrupted themselves. British Empire, the Spanish Empire, the French. They did it all to themselves. And William Graham Sumner asked, well, isn't there a lesson here for Americans? Shouldn't we pay attention to this history? And of course, there is a lesson here for ordinary Americans, for tax-paying Americans. But the elite, the moneyed elite who control the government, who are linked to the government, they don't care about those lessons because they're the ones who profit. They're the ones who bask in the power and the glory, as it was said, that is a result of these wars. And so they don't care if the rest of the country goes to hell as a result of these wars. It's all about them. And he asked the question, you know, why do Americans think anyway that they have a civilizing mission? Why is it our responsibility to civilize the world, to teach the world about democracy and self-government. And that's where this essay comes in that I mentioned before the class on the chat, the essay by Mel Bradford, the late Mel Bradford, in his book, A Better Guide Than Reason, that I see Cam just put the link to it up on the Amazon link on the chat. And Mel Bradford in this essay entitled Lincoln, the Declaration and Secular Puritanism, A Rhetoric for Continuing Revolution, made the point that Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, when he claimed that the America was founded on the notion that all men are created equal, which it wasn't. Egalitarianism was the French Revolution. It was communism was egalitarianism. It wasn't the founding of America, as far as that goes. But that's what Lincoln said. But then, you know, the Republican Party claimed that there was a new birth of freedom and after the American Civil War. And this freedom was not supposed to be restricted to Americans. By the time you get to the late 19th century, the argument was being made that all men everywhere, deserved equal freedom. That includes men in Europe and Asia and Africa and all over the globe. And therefore, it is the exceptional Americans, you know, that who had this treasury of virtue because of what they did in the Civil War, supposedly, who had the obligation or the duty to make sure that all men are created equal everywhere. That's why Mel Bradford called this rhetoric a rhetoric for continuing revolution. And to give you a current example of this, in Barack Obama's second inaugural address, he boasted about American military aggressions in the name of humanitarianism, of course, in Iraq, Afghanistan, Egypt, Yemen, and Libya, while threatening war with Syria and Iran. And he said this in his second inaugural address: "We again declare that the regime of Bashar al-Assad must come to an end." So what is the justification? What would be the justification for all these wars? Well, no American presidents anymore use the United States Constitution as their justification, their legal justification for anything. And here's what Obama said. He said, "We," speaking for all Americans, I guess, but he's really speaking for himself and maybe a dozen or so of his appointees, "we have taken these positions," that is, agitating for war with Syria and Iran, "we have taken these positions because we believe that freedom and self-determination are not unique to one culture. These are not simply American values or Western values. They are universal values. And even as there will be huge challenges that come with a transition to democracy, I am convinced that ultimately government of the people, by the people, and for the people is more likely to bring about the stability, prosperity, and individual opportunity that serve as a basis for peace in our world." So there he is, literally paraphrasing, directly quoting Abe Lincoln to quote, justify massive American military intervention all over the Middle East and elsewhere. And then he said this, he said, "America will never retreat from the world, and no government or company, no school or NGO will be confident working in a country where its people are in danger. Our citizens must be secure and our efforts must be welcome," end quote. So he's saying, in any country in the world where there is danger, he, the American president, reserves the right to send missiles and to send bombs and to send armies to make sure that Americans can go about some kind of business there without danger. So that is, if that is not totalitarian imperialism, there is no such thing as imperialism. But that's what William Graham Sumner was warning about in 1898 when he asked, "Well, why do we have a civilizing mission?" And he was mocking the idea of a civilizing mission when he said that. Now, the Spanish Empire at the time was winding down. It had very little, there wasn't much of a Spanish Empire left. Cuba, Puerto Rico, the Philippines, they were all essentially stolen from them by the Americans at the time. But they had believed in mercantilism. Their economic, guiding economic theory was mercantilism. and among the tenets of mercantilism was the false belief that wealth was the result of the accumulation of precious metals like gold and silver. And so as a result, that supposedly was a justification for conquering other countries to steal their gold and silver and have the king of Spain accumulate it and hold on to it. And of course, that made the king wealthy, but it had nothing whatsoever to do with the well-being of the ordinary Spaniard. And so what William Graham Sumner is saying is that, well, this mercantilism was intellectually decapitated by Adam Smith in 1776 in his famous book, The Wealth of Nations. This is an ancient, defunct superstition, mercantilism, and yet that's what guided Spain in its belief that it could become wealthy through imperialism. But of course, it bankrupted itself through imperialism. It did not become wealthy. It did the opposite. It bankrupted itself. And of course, the point he's making is that why are we doing the same thing? And well, again, the reason is that it benefits a relatively small group of people. And some are called them the old money, sort of the old money people from the Northeast, the old Yankees from the Civil War era, the Northern business and banking elite, the people who bankrolled Abe Lincoln and the Republican Party in the Civil War. And all throughout the Indian Wars, the people who bankrolled the building of the government-subsidized railroads, and the people who became very, very wealthy through government subsidies to the transcontinental railroads, and now they were the same people or their descendants were still the old money people of the Northeast, New England, New York, Philadelphia, who were agitating for war because they're the ones who are going to profit from war and bask in the so-called glory of war and empire. Another point that Sumner makes is that it's a matter of mind, he says, that sees other people. He makes note of the fact that the advocates of imperialistic wars are always talking about other people as less human than us. And so once they're seen as less human, then unlimited cruelty toward them is supposedly okay. So the Southerners were demonized with novels like Uncle Tom's Cabin and many other works of propaganda by the Republican Party during the Civil War and after and to this day. And that supposedly justified the mass murder of tens of thousands of Southern civilians, women and children, and the bombing of entire cities like Atlanta and Charleston, and they're burning to the ground. And then came the war of extermination against the Plains Indians, who were demonized and dehumanized as savages, and the U.S. government murdered them by the tens of thousands. And then came the Spanish-American War. And the Spanish-American War, it is said that, and in the put down of the revolt of the Filipinos afterwards, after the Spanish-American War by the Teddy Roosevelt administration, the U.S. Army killed more than 200,000 Filipinos. And Joseph Stromberg points out in the article that I put in his on the reading list for tonight that the estimates of the deaths of Filipinos at the hands of the Americans in the late 19th and early 20th centuries is as high as 220,000, but also the number of combatants, the number of Filipino men under arms, is thought to be around 15,000. That's 15,000. So in other words, once they dehumanized the Filipinos and compared them to the Indians and or to Southerners or to blacks, who were also considered by the post-Civil War U.S. Army as less than human in many ways. You might remember some of the quotes from General Sherman that I mentioned last week. Well, once they were dehumanized, the U.S. Government went about murdering what would the number be, 180,000 to 200,000 men, women and children and old men in the Philippines during the late 19th and early 20th century in the name of teaching them how to be civilized. And you know, who are the civilized ones and who are the barbarians here? Is the big question. Sumner goes on to say, you know, he goes back to the Abe Lincoln lingo, all men are created equal. And so he said, this is always justified, this rhetoric from the Gettysburg Address, that all men are created equal, to so-called liberate other people so that they can be governed by us. Maybe not directly by us, but through a puppet. The reason why there's been conflict with Iran for so many years is that the U.S. government overthrew the democratically elected president of Iran in the 1950s and imposed a puppet dictator, the Shah of Iran, to work as our dictator. And so in the name of all men being created equal, is that we claim to the world that it is liberating other people to be governed by us, by Americans. And William Graham Sumner smoked that out decades before the Shah of Iran came around. Another argument that is often made, Sumner said, this is 1898, is that, quote, we must devise a government for them, for somebody else. And again, it's just remarkable how there must be a textbook or a handbook. When you become president of the United States, the current generation of the old money people, the big money people who run the government, must give the president the handbook of things to say and things to do to keep the empire going. Here's what Obama said in his speech to the United Nations in 2012. This was September 25th, 2012, speech to the United Nations. He mentioned the CIA spook, Crystal Stevens, who was killed in Benghazi. And so he was killed by anti-American protesters. And he praised Chris Stevens before the United Nations for having gone to Libya as his representative, as Obama's representative, to do what? For, in his words, quote, crafted a vision for a future for Libyans, end quote. So look at what Sumner is saying. Sumner in 1898 is mocking the idea that, quote, we must devise a government for them. Therefore, we are going to invade, conquer, and occupy them, whatever country. At his time, he's talking about possessions of Spain, Cuba, Puerto Rico, the Philippines. And here's Obama, more than 100 years later, saying, my representative was over there in Libya crafting a vision for the future of Libya. It's the same old line that Sumner knew that had been used by the Spanish Empire, the British Empire, other empires. And now we've got the American twist, the American spin on the same old argument. Another point that he makes is that the thirst for glory the thirst for glory is an epidemic which robs people of their judgment, seduces their vanity, cheats them of their interests, and corrupts their consciences. That's quite a mouthful. A thirst for glory. In some of my own research, when I was researching my book, Hamilton's Curse, it was kind of creepy to read some of Alexander Hamilton's words when he kept using the phrase imperial glory. He was just itching to get into a war with France or Spain or another war with England for imperial glory. And of course, it's always the people like himself who would have been basking in the glory while other people were dying. And it's also people like himself and his business associates who would be making a lot of money as defense contractors. And here's a very important point that Sumner makes. He says, the essence of militarism is to despise constitutions, to sneer at parliaments, and to look with contempt at civilians. Ask yourself how true this is of today's world, the United States, to despise constitutions. After 9/11, I can remember all of the cheerleaders for war among all the neocon talking heads on radio and television adopted the mantra that 9/11 changes everything, and by which they meant, the hell with the Constitution, no more civil liberties. Let's pass the Patriot Act, and let's let the government spy on every last American. So and that is contempt for the Constitution. And I wrote an article about this at the time on lewrockwell.com. I think it was entitled, Why They Hate Our Freedoms. And the word they was in quotation marks. Because this was the argument the neocons made from the very beginning of why there were terrorist attacks in the United States. It was the stupid argument that we have freedom over here, and people who don't like freedom therefore bombed us. But of course, we had more freedom 50 years ago in many ways, and why weren't they bombing us then would be one question that should be asked. But in the point that I make in this old article of mine from LewRockwell.com is if you look at what the neocons themselves did when they were in power during the Bush administration, they're the ones who hate our freedom with warrantless wiretapping, warrantless searches, NSA spying, the Patriot Act, and the suspension of habeas corpus was something they were dying to achieve. And they're the ones who hate our freedom, not Osama bin Laden and his gang. And so to sneer at Parliament, to sneer at democracy, and to look with contempt at civilians, that's certainly if you see the way today's police, and who are mostly military veterans nowadays, the younger ones especially, they certainly do look with contempt upon civilians. And an important point that Sumner makes also is that imperialism is destructive of democracy. Even though it's always done in the name of spreading democracy, it actually destroys democracy. And the average member of the public doesn't really understand it. Doesn't understand that he's being bamboozled here, and that his democracy is actually being diminished, if not totally destroyed, in the name of spreading democracy somewhere else. And one of the things that will happen if we get on this road, someone said, is that the president, the American president, will be viewed more or less like an emperor and a warlord. And of course, if he has that kind of power, emperor and warlord, he must be obeyed. And therefore, it's a no-no to criticize the emperor and warlord when he proposes yet another war. And so, and that's pretty much is what has happened, hasn't it? Our presidents have become like emperors who believe they have the ability to send missiles to any country in the world without anyone's permission, without consulting with Congress or anybody else, without looking at the Constitution, without a constitutionally imposed declaration of war. Even Bill Clinton lobbed a missile at an aspirin factory in the Sudan on the day of Monica Lewinsky's grand jury testimony, just to divert the public's attention away from her testimony, because he knew the bombing would be the top of the news. And so that certainly is emperor-like behavior and warlord-type behavior. Sumner also makes a very learned point that is made by Ludwig von Mises in his book Human Action, in the war chapter on war and the economy, and that he was referring to Europe. He said at that time that he was writing this, Europe was becoming more and more militarized, especially Germany, and he was noticing that they were destroying their own capitalist economy. After spending the mid to late 19th century building up markets and capitalism and becoming much, much better off economically, capitalism was being destroyed by militarism. In his words, he says, the European economies were being arrested, diverted, and crippled. And of course, this is the point that von Mises makes in Human Action and in some of his other essays on the topic of war, and that capitalism is essentially a network of the international division of labor and specialization, where millions of people from all over the world specialize in different things, and they make money in those things. They cooperate with each other to produce and sell those things. And the trades that take place are all mutually beneficial. And the more trade, the better, as long as it's voluntary and without fraud. And war is exactly the opposite of that. War not only puts a stop to trade and exchange, but it diverts capital that would have been used to produce goods and services for the people, for the consumers, is used to create armaments instead, to create bombs that blow people up and blow buildings up and so forth. And so that's what the European economies are doing. And Sumner is saying, let's not go down this road. because there's an opportunity cost here. He didn't say opportunity cost. He didn't use that economic term, but that's what he was thinking. Obviously, if you read this passage, that the cost to us will be economic destruction. You know, there's no way around it. So in other words, he was never fooled by the broken window fallacy. He did not believe that war could be good for the economy. War is always bad for the economy, although it's good for war profiteers, you know, some people in the economy. And so how will we become like the old empires, Sumner is saying? You know, how do we know when we have become just like the old Spanish Empire, the old British Empire, French Empire, and so forth? What were the characteristics of these empires? Now think about this and ask yourself, how many of these things are characteristics of the United States Empire today? War, debt, taxation, diplomacy, a grand government system, pomp, glory, big army, big navy, lavish expenditures, political jobbery, and in a word, imperialism. So all of these are the ingredients of imperialism, and these are all the ingredients of the American government today, to be sure. To be sure, never-ending war. When haven't Americans been at war in the past 150 years? When haven't they been involved in some kind of war somewhere? The number of years is relatively small if you think about it. Debt, war always leads to unbelievable debt, as we've got now. Heavy taxation, diplomacy, you know, the image of John Kerry, diplomacy. And so this is imperialism. This is what imperialism. And the final point that he makes, one of the final points I'll make here about Sumner, is that he says the great foe of democracy is plutocracy. That is, government of the rich few, by the rich few, for the rich few. Who could argue that this is not a feature of American democracy today? In fact, there's a great article that explains this in great detail today on lewrockwell.com by David Stockman, the former Reagan administration budget director, who wrote this great book that he wrote. I have a copy here. The Great Deformation, David Stockman's book, the subtitle being The Corruption of Capitalism in America. It's a big fat book. It's how many pages? It's almost 800 pages long. But the article today on lewrockwell.com is a speech that he made outlining some of the basic facts of how the welfare warfare state primarily benefits the 1%ers, especially the Wall Street 1%ers, while impoverishing just about everybody else. And so the great foe of democracy, said William Graham Sumner in 1898, is plutocracy. And that's what we've got, plutocracy. And plutocracy is always fueled by militarism. I see Cam put the link there on the chat to Stockman's article. Plutocracy is always fueled by militarism, and for four reasons. Reason one is jobbery, that is contracts, government contracts to the politically connected. Also, it diverts the public's attention away from the fact that the economy is not doing too well. Nothing like a good war or a good foreign policy crisis to get the public's attention diverted away from their economic problems. Large government expenditures that end up in the hands of a few, we certainly have that. And number four, large expenditure and debt make the strong stronger and the weak weaker, says William Graham Sumner. And it's hard to imagine that anyone would disagree with that as a caricature of today's U.S. system. The final argument that Sumner makes is that he points out that the imperialists, the advocates of never-ending imperialistic wars, are always saying, well, we should abandon the Jeffersonian foreign policy of commercial relationships with all nations and entangling alliances with none, because times have changed. Times have changed. Well, true, times do change, but that doesn't mean mass murdering people who have never done you harm is a moral thing to do ever. And as I said a few minutes ago, the mantra of the modern day imperialists, the neoconservatives, after 9/11 was 9/11 has changed everything. Everything is different. Lincoln, they take after Lincoln. Lincoln, in one of his speeches, says, we must think anew and act anew. Use A-N-E-W, anew. That was Lincoln's way of saying, the hell with the United States Constitution. We must think anew and act anew and abandon the founding fathers and their stupid ideas. And he did. And he essentially became a dictator. So some version of this argument is always made by the advocates of imperialism and the Lincoln-loving neocons, as I call them, the Lincoln cult. They started making this argument, 9/11 changed everything. It was their version of Lincoln's think anew and act anew. There was even an article in the Wall Street Journal online by Newt Gingrich around 2008, 2009, something like that. I think it was entitled Lincoln and Bush. Either that or Bush and Lincoln, one or the other. And he argued for a military invasion of, let me see if I can remember the countries, of Iran, Saudi Arabia, Lebanon, North Korea, and Syria. And he quoted Lincoln and saying, we must think anew and act anew. He was saying, the heck with the Constitution. We don't need constitutional authority. We need Lincoln's political rhetoric. And so he used that direct quote in justifying, trying to justify starting up five or six new wars, because at the time, of course, the war in Iraq was going so wonderfully that and was so beneficial for all Americans that he thought we needed five or six more, the crazy Newt Gingrich. And so they never fail to fall on the rhetoric. You know, tonight I've quoted Barack Obama as quoting Abe Lincoln and trying to justify invading Syria and Iran. And I also just quoted Newt Gingrich as quoting Abe Lincoln as trying to justify the invasion of Syria and Iran. And so what has replaced the Constitution as presidential authority to wage war is the political rhetoric of Abe Lincoln. That's what American presidents, Democrats and Republicans alike, use nowadays to, quote, justify aggressive wars of imperialism all over the world. It's what they think gives them the moral authority to brutalize and mass murder foreigners who have never done them any harm or anybody else in this country. Now, with regard to the Spanish-American War, the War Party wanted a war, and they were right. They were came right on and said they wanted glory for the American state. That's why they wanted the Spanish-American War. They were bored because the late 19th century, you know, apart from the mass murder of the Indians. That pretty much ended by 1890. Most Americans were very busy at work making capitalism work. The ex-slaves were busy making lives for themselves and their children and grandchildren. They were becoming farmers and sharecroppers and businessmen and women and doing some remarkable things. And of course, we had the Industrial Revolution. So Americans were very preoccupied with just going to work and getting down to business. And the old money people, as Sumner called them, were bored with this. They were bored. They wanted glory for the state. And so they're the ones who instigated the Spanish-American War. And, of course, there was no evidence that Spain had anything to do with the battleship Maine sinking. And they wanted national greatness. This is the same thing that, you know, fast forward to William Crystal and a co-author, I think it was David Brooks, in the Wall Street Journal in 1996, wrote their initial article on national greatness conservatism. They claimed that Teddy Roosevelt was one of their heroes, so they hearkened back to the good old days of the early 20th century when America became an imperialist power. And they claimed that now that the Cold War was over, they too were bored. Bill Kristol was bored. And so he wanted us, the U.S. government, to do something really, really big, like build a tunnel under the Atlantic Ocean to England, or maybe bomb every country, every Arab country in the Middle East, something like that, to make us great. And it's the same argument that that was made 100 years ago, more than 100 years ago, by the imperialists who wanted a war with Spain. And they were saying that national greatness required a huge naval power, and but the question that should be asked is, well, who wants national greatness? Great for who? It's certainly not great for the taxpayers. It's not great for the people who are drafted into the army and made into slaves. It's not good for great for the people who die in these wars. Well, it's great for the military contractors and the military industrial complex. That's who it's great for. To justify the Spanish-American War and even American entry into World War One, there was an element that used an economic argument that supposedly capitalism had some sort of flaw in it that created surpluses. And so to get rid of these surpluses, we had to bully our way in other countries, so the argument was. But there's nothing inherent about capitalism that creates surpluses. It's the government's price supports, especially in agriculture, that create surpluses. Price floors, yeah, that'll create surpluses or subsidies that cause the production of excess amounts of products that are not justified by consumer demand. Yeah, that'll create surpluses. But that's interventionism. Interventionism causes surpluses, not capitalism itself. And so this superstition was embraced as a sort of a subsidiary argument for war at the time, at the late 19th, early 20th century. And so in the end, the U.S. conquered Guam, the Marianas, Philippines, Puerto Rico, and Cuba was taken over as a, quote, protectorate. It was called a protectorate. And we had our war of extermination. This is what led to the creation of the Anti-Imperialist League. And there were some very prominent Americans who belonged to this, like Andrew Carnegie, the steel industry millionaire, and President Grover Cleveland, the last good Democrat, as I call him. Grover Cleveland was a member of the Anti-Imperialist League. And here's I picked out a few quotes from Stromberg about World War One. There's one in particular in section 4 of his article that really summarizes nicely what was going on at the time that the Americans decided to enter a European war. He writes this, and I'll quote him, quote, "While murder and madness reigned overseas, Americans followed the peaceful, boring, and inglorious pursuits of the marketplace. Capital formation, wealth creation, and mass production for mass markets. That's what Americans were doing." Okay, they didn't want war. They were going to work. They were investing, starting up businesses, running their business. They didn't want this. It was the old money elite who wanted this, and the people with the political connection who wanted this. And they were helped, by the way, by some of the crazy post-millennial pietists in academia and elsewhere, such as Woodrow Wilson, who believed that the power of government should be used to try to create heaven on earth. And unless they did that and create a 1,000-year kingdom of God on earth, they themselves could not be saved and go to heaven. Woodrow Wilson was one of these. He was a post-millennial pietist. And so they went about with the Lusitania scam to justify the war. But I think I already mentioned in the class that in the name of promoting democracy and self-government elsewhere, we had the repressive espionage and sedition acts that caught no spies. No spies were prosecuted under these laws, but Americans lost their freedom, lost their civil liberties. Here's what Stromberg says. No spies were caught, but Americans lost their freedom. He quotes sociologist Robert Nisbet as saying, "I believe it no exaggeration to say that the West's first real experience with totalitarianism, political absolutism extended into every possible area, with a kind of terror always waiting in the wings, came with the American war state under Woodrow Wilson. Mass conscription rushed into law, and all resistance was crushed." End quote. As I said, the mildest criticism of the war could end you in jail. The Pledge of Allegiance was adopted in 1892, the year 1892. This is not something that came from the Founding Fathers. This came from a defrocked Baptist minister named Francis Bellamy in 1892. And so it was the Pledge of Allegiance to the Omnipotent State is what it is. That's why I certainly never say the Pledge of Allegiance or stand up or anything like that. Never anyone does it, because it's a Pledge of Allegiance to the Omnipotent State that came about from the nationalistic hysteria that was drummed up during the Spanish-American War and carried through to World War I. And so it's evil. It's an evil course to those of us who are opposed to imperialism and the American government being the world's bully and waging war for the benefit of a plutocracy. And so that's what you're doing. You're pledging your allegiance to the plutocracy, who are the main and only beneficiaries of the warfare state. You say the Pledge of Allegiance. And it was originally taken, the Pledge of Allegiance, from the loyalty oath that Confederate soldiers were forced to take when they were captured as prisoners of war. A lot of them were told that either you take this oath or you'll be shot. And so, of course, they took the oath and you know, whatever it meant, being in prison doesn't mean much. But that was the origins of the Pledge of Allegiance. And so that's why the words one nation under God was added in the 1950s by Eisenhower. But the one nation indivisible part meant the recreation of the American Union at gunpoint by the Lincoln administration. One nation indivisible, meaning no state, the citizens of any state no longer have the right to withdraw from the Union. It's indivisible. Try to divide it again and we will kill you, is basically what that part of the Pledge of Allegiance said. We did it in the 1860s and we'll do it again in the 1890s, they were saying. One nation, individual, indivisible. Okay, and so that's, I think I'll stop there. It's about 46 minutes that I've been going on here. And I'll do what we usually do. If you have any questions, I'll give it a shot and try to answer any questions that anyone has. Questions are not mandatory. There's no penalty. You won't be fined. Let's see, from Danny, I guess, at the Mises Institute. I talked about Hoppe's paradox of imperialism in the first class. It was one of the first readings, was Hans Hoppe's article that mentioned this. And I think he's right on. One of the things that sticks in my mind about Hans Hoppe's writings on imperialism is, you know, what the imperialists of our day have been saying is that democracy will end war. We need to enforce democracy on these countries, because look at post-World War II Europe. We had all these democracies, although we also had all these communist dictatorships. We had all these democracies. They didn't war against each other. Well, Hoppe made the point that, well, of course they didn't. They were all essentially a part of the American Empire. And the American military made sure they didn't war against each other. And he compares that to the fact that, well, none of the Soviet republics made war on each other either, because, of course, if they did, the Russians would have come in and put an end to it with their tanks. And so he sort of draws a parallel there between the U.S. and the Soviets in making sure that their respective empires, if you will, played nice with each other. And so I think that was a good point to be made about this idea that democracy leads to peace, when in fact democracy leads to conflict. Well, the Monroe Doctrine, John is asking about the Monroe Doctrine. Well, it's mentioned in several of the readings for tonight. I didn't really harp on it, but yes, that was the doctrine that was often used to supposedly justify American imperialism in the 19th century and early 20th century. And so yes, it was, I didn't mention it really, I don't think, but I did put it on the reading list so that you could read a little bit about it. Let's see, John is also asking about adversaries, about supporting a central bank. Well, they all have central banks, or due to the fact that the majority of these adversary nations are hostile to Israel. Well, adversary nations. I guess John is referring to countries like Syria, which the Likud party in Israel does not like. And so I can't think of any good reason why young American soldiers should be fighting and dying for the Likud party in Israel. Israel has nukes. They have their own government, their own army. If they want a war with Syria, good luck. Have at it. But leave me out of it is my attitude. But yes, that's who a lot of our, so supposedly our adversary, Syria, has never done anything to Americans. It doesn't threaten to do anything. Neither does Iran, for that matter. And so we're supposedly fighting Israel's wars if we get into war with these people. And of course, Israel has nukes, and Iran does not, and Syria does not. And so they can take care of themselves. One of my blogs at lourockwell.com not too long ago, I quoted an article from the Jerusalem Post that said that Israelis were, I think, were 7-1, according to the opinion poll, against going to war with Syria. But 3/4 of the Israelis thought it would be a good idea if the Americans let their sons and daughters die and spent their trillions of dollars on a war with Syria. But they were 7-1 against sending their sons and daughters to die in a war with Syria and in Israel. And so I think that pretty much says it all. I didn't get all the way up to the Bay of Pigs. Let's see. Yeah, Sheila ran across an article. Maybe you can send it to Danny or Cam, or put a link if you can onto the chat. That sounds kind of interesting. International relations as a mafia principle. Well, Murray Rothbard famously said in a number of places that government is just another criminal gang writ large. I think it's in his article, the Anatomy of the State, where as one of the places where Murray Rothbard made that argument, where if you look at a lot of the things the government does, that if an individual were to drop a bomb on somebody and kill them, it's murder. You should go to jail or have a punishment for it. But if a really big gang of people call themselves government and drop a bomb on innocent people who have not harmed them, well, that's okay. That's foreign policy. And so if you want another article, an older article by Rothbard, there it is. Look it up. I think it's his essay on the Anatomy of the State, where he makes that argument. I didn't mention the Bay of Pigs, but you can see my article, the article on the lifeware warfare state for tonight's reading goes over some of the earlier ones, the earlier false flag operations like the Bay of Pigs. But I wrote a later article on Mises.org about that also. It does talk about the Bay of Pigs, where there was supposedly two attacks on American ships. I don't want to get into it in too much detail. I guess I don't want to go too far afield from what I did say. But I didn't mention the Bay of Pigs earlier. Let's see, Jeff, I'm not sure if Sumner didn't think the Mexican-American War was an imperialist war. He was just commenting on the war of his day, which was the Spanish-American War. But I think he would have thought, Jeff, that the Mexican-American War was an imperialist war. He was commenting on the war fever that was being drummed up at that moment, 1898. I knew Cam would come up with that article. We'll have to take a look at it. And the Israelis, there was a guy who was the head of the Bin Laden unit at the CIA, who kind of came out in favor of Ron Paul. He sounded like he was disgusted with it all, and he was on TV for a short while, and he said things like, "No more American boys should die for the government of Israel," and then he kind of disappeared from TV. I haven't seen him in at least a year or more on any of the news shows, but. I think more and more people seem to be realizing that. So what are we doing over there in the Middle East? Why is Syria a threat to us? Why is Iran a threat to America? They're not threatening to do anything to us. And of course, you never know what all the motivations are. But somebody is going to make a lot of money on any war. And you know, ever since when the Cold War ended, there was a lot of talk about a peace dividend. And this was terrifying for the military-industrial complex. So what the peace dividend supposedly was, well, we no longer need to spend all these billions of dollars on the military. Now, what are we going to do with all this money? And so the military was in a panic, the military-industrial complex. And ever since then, they've been trying to scare the daylights out of people with stories of new Hitlers, whether they're in Iraq or Libya or Egypt or Syria, Lebanon, Africa, somewhere, to keep the gravy train going, the military-industrial complex. And there's my blog that Cam dug up. I'm not an expert on the Treaty of Westphalia that Fred is asking about, so I'm afraid I can't answer that one. Well, sure, AIPAC, John is asking about AIPAC. Well, surely a special interest group like that is very wealthy is able to get members of Congress in war. Bill Kristol, his father was called himself the godfather of neoconservatism. So I guess that would make Bill Kristol, the grandson of neoconservatism. He made a speech a while back bragging to AIPAC, to an AIPAC convention, that they have bought every member of Congress save a couple, save Ron Paul when he was still there and maybe a few more. But he was bragging that maybe like 99% of the U.S. Congress would vote in whatever way AIPAC wanted them to vote on matters relating to wars in the Middle East. So he's bragging about that. So they have been very successful. And of course, it's very easy for these people to try to censor discussion by calling you an anti-Semite if you happen to disagree with the Likud party. You're a Holocaust denier or something like that. They're very good at playing that sort of game. And my article on my short article on lifefare warfare state. I briefly talked about the Mexican American War as an imperialistic adventure, also. and that is no secret. Yeah, Chris is. It isn't amazing that there are American military commando raids in Libya and Somalia, of all places. You know, the U.S. government has an African command that is run out of Stuttgart, Germany. And so we apparently want to command all the governments in Africa. And so, and anyone who doesn't behave, we have commando raids. And so, yeah, that's par for the course. It's routine. Somebody in Libya is not behaving in the way we would like them to behave in terms of their government. And so we go in and kill them. That's why, you know, the president of Egypt, who was duly elected, we had to get rid of him, even though millions of Egyptians voted for him, because he was misbehaving. He wasn't taking orders as quickly as our government in America would like him to take. So he had to go. And so, what business do Americans, and you wonder why people all over the world hate Americans, and all these things make life more dangerous for Americans, because if we want to travel to these places, people there have a memory. They have a memory. Oh yeah, American soldiers killed my uncle. Why are we going to feel welcomed in Libya and these places where we have these commando raids and where we have no business at all of being? So yeah, that's the only comment I would have. Well, John is asking about political correctness in the Holocaust. Well, yeah, you don't need legal protection. That it's nonsense. Holocaust deniers have thousands and thousands of people who always jump all over them. So there's no need to have a law saying you can't say that any more than you need a law prohibiting any kind of speech. Let's see, Sheila is recommending another book. I haven't heard of that one, The Anglo-American Establishment. There's another very old book called The Americanization of the World. It was published, early 20th century. I have a copy of it, and it was about the Americanization of the world that had been commenced as a result of things like the Spanish-American War and the American entry into World War I. And capitalism, there was sort of a good version of the Americanization of the world, of the spreading of the American methods of capitalism, not imperialism, but markets. But that's another very old book. I don't know about the reabsorption of the U.S. by the British Empire. That sounds very unlikely, though, Sheila. That sounds the British Empire is pathetic. I remember being in first time I went to England was 1984, and it was basically a third world country. The telephone didn't work. The unions had shut down the coal mines. The electricity was sketchy, and this was before Thatcher privatized a lot of the industry. So it's hard to imagine that they would have the power to recapture America in some sort of de facto way. Sounds like a good movie topic though. Let's see, will I be commenting more on imperialism leading to government insolvency? Well, just look at the state of the United States government today with the trillion-dollar plus debt. And the war, when the Iraq war started, President Bush's, George W. Bush's top economic advisor was a man named Larry Lindsey. And Larry Lindsey was asked to give an estimate of the cost of the war, and his estimate was $160 billion. He was fired a couple of days later personally by Dick Cheney, the vice president. because the neocons decided that the war was not going to cost anything. They decided that the party line was going to be, well, we will capture Iraq's oil wells and we will sell the oil and that'll pay for the war. And so it's not only will it not cost anything, but we might actually make money on the deal, they said, and put it back in the U.S. Treasury. And that, of course, was all a big lie. And, you know, it has cost many hundreds of billions of dollars, much more than Larry Lindsey ever speculated or forecast back then in what got him fired from that job. And so, yes, if you want to look at insolvency, you're looking at it. The government is broke. And at some point, people will quit buying these bonds. The Chinese and others are going to quit buying these bonds. And then that's when the crash will occur. And so Americans might finally wake up at that point to what's going on. But today, you know, the primary interest is, you know, when does Dancing with the Stars start up again? When does the new season start? Or who is the next bachelorette? That's pretty much on the agenda of most America, you know, television silliness. But once people stop buying all this debt and the welfare state collapses, then people will probably start paying attention. Well, Cecil Rhodes may have wanted to recapture America, but that doesn't mean he was successful in any way whatsoever. Yeah, well, you know, keep in mind, you know, if Cecil Rhodes or his political descendants wanted to influence American politics, there are also a lot of other people who want to influence American politics. And so whenever these theories crop up about a cabal of people taking control and being the real controllers of the government, you know, the reality is there are a lot of people who influence the government every day. And so no one group, no one small cabal is able to capture all of the government. That's why we're insolvent, essentially, because government, the U.S. government today says no to nobody. It pretty much any organized special interest group that wants anything gets whatever it wants. And so sky's the limit. The Fed just prints up more money. The press has always been subservient because I think I might have mentioned this last week in that the economics behind it is that if you're a reporter and you know you report on different subjects, you might be a labor reporter, an environmental reporter, a national defense reporter, you get most of your information from the government. And so if you're not too friendly to the government, you can have your information cut off from you and your career is destroyed. And so that's why reporters are naturally not too critical of the government. They might play the game of asking Republican A a question of what is your criticism of Democrat B and so forth, but they don't criticize the regime because they'll be cut off from the information flow and their career is over if they do that. So you don't need to rely on any kind of conspiracy theory or anything like that to understand why the media, with a few exceptions, are sympathetic to bigger government and perpetual warfare and the welfare worker state. It's in their economic self-interest to do so. And plus, most of them went to journalism school, and journalism schools are sort of like left-wing indoctrination camps, first and foremost. And so to the extent that they, when they were 18, 19, 20 years old and developing a personal political ideology, it became leftism. Well, the internet makes it pretty irrelevant that most of the media is owned by a few corporations, because these corporations don't control the information flow anymore, thanks to the internet. Especially with the younger generation, younger people don't watch television. know, with regard to the media, there's so many media outlets, not just, there's so many websites, so many, so much to do on the internet, and even the print press that's out there. There's still, you can still go online and read The Guardian of England, for example, the newspaper that's broke the NSA scandals. And so it doesn't really matter that a few corporations, own some newspapers, because it's a different world today. Maybe 50 years ago, they controlled the information flow much better, but technology has broken that apart, I think. Yeah, Sheila, that's true. We still do see a lot of beat up old trucks driven by guys with ball caps with the name of some aircraft carrier on it with Romney stickers, GOP stickers, and so forth. H.L. Mencken called them Bubas Americanas. Okay, well, it looks like we're kind of running out of gas then. Things are slowing down. Maybe we'll call it a night then. And thanks again for participating. I hope you were able to learn something from tonight. And next week we'll talk about the anti-imperialist tradition in America.